So we continue Xinjinmei in our study, and we are on this line, gain and loss, right and wrong, abandon this at once. Commentary. Once we see that all ideas about gain and loss, right and wrong, are nothing more than dream projections, it is possible to drop them as a frame of reference. We train ourselves instead to use language more carefully and creatively so that these dualities are seen as nothing more than conceptual constructs without any inherent meaning to them. Chan, Zen, and Buddhist traditions have never been comfortable with the equivalent of biblical notions of right and wrong or just and unjust. Such thoughts are seen as impediments to clear seeing, to making the world transparent through radical transformation. Just as dreams confuse our reality of the waking state, so do the dualities of right and wrong, gain and loss, disturb the inner calm. All of these dualistic distinctions are like throwing rocks into a still pond and disturbing its surface of calmness. So, I think this is very potent, and we need to look at it, take some time to look at it, right? Because more often than not, our world is defined, our reality, our lives, our identity, defined by our ideas of right and wrong, which I think we don't consider them as ideas. We consider them as etched in stone. Of course there is right, and of course there's wrong. Who could argue with that, right? So how do we work with that? How do we loosen that? Or what does it even mean when it says abandon this at once? Gain and loss, right and wrong. Abandon this, all of them at once, right? And what he's saying in the commentary is that these are nothing more than dream projections. It is possible to drop them as a frame of reference. So what does it mean, right and wrong, for us or for you? And what does it mean to drop them? What does it mean to have them as points of reference? I think it's easier to go there first before we talk about dropping anything. We have to understand what it is that we are working with. Yeah. We need wheels for the tripod, right? So, and a remote control.
Yeah, there you go. Throw the rope in.
Right.
Yeah, I'm glad that you changed it to point of reference, because it helps me kind of, something that jumps out at me about this that is, I don't know if trap is the right word, but being willing to kind of drop everything if needed. There's a lot of people that I've met in my life, and I'm sure that others have as well, that seemingly are able to do that, but it's often without seeing the whole, so they don't even see the wake of pain and suffering and destruction that their decisions can make sometimes, mm-hmm. by being mm-hmm. willing to drop everything,
right,
on a dime,
right,
just
right.
go, I don't need you anymore, or whatever it is. And so thinking about it in those terms of going, rather than it being, you're dropping the concepts of gain and loss, it, by referring to it as a point of reference, it opens up the possibility of those terms being upaya as opposed to guiding principles, and that allows you to see it. Because if the goal of all of this is to open up everything, that includes the mess and the harm that we cause by trying to leave no trace. Sometimes I think often of the example that you gave a number of times of the turtle going onto the beach,
right.
Uses its tail to hide its tracks so the predator can't find where they place the eggs, but you're still making a trail with your tail covering up your footprints. And so it's this always this, you have to really reckon with all of it.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get to choose that. You can recognize gains and losses, but it's not a game. in that sense. So.
Right. Let me just have the microphone back for a second. So thank you for that. So maybe we should clarify the meaning of point of reference, right? So if you remember last in our last discussion, it was referred to as self-referentiality, right? It's not just general points, right? It is points that allow us or give us a sense of self, right? So the right and wrong are not just right and wrong. It's right and wrong that I can identify with, that I support, that define me. I am this kind of a person. I am this kind of a right person. And I'm not that kind of a wrong person, right? So what we want to do, and you touched on that, right? We want to infuse it with flexible energy, right? It's not that we have to drop it as, I mean, otherwise we can't function, right? So we have to have points of references, right? Every day, every moment. And that's fine. That's not the problem, or that's not the trap. The trap is looking for myself and then finding an idea of me that I can then crawl into, right? So now in terms of right and wrong, well, obviously it's very flexible, right? I mean, you know, we don't have to, just simple examples, or a simple example, right? So if you're invited to, like, you've heard this before, like a Bedouin feast, right? If you don't burp after the meal, it's an insult. If you burp after a meal, if you go to England, for example, you know, and you're invited to a meal, that's an insult. So is it wrong to burp or is it right to burp? I mean, it's a simple example. It's not, you know, right? It's not so big, but the mechanism is the same. The rightness and the wrongness are made up. It's not that we should not learn and study, right? So if you're invited, you do want to find out what are the customs here, right? What's right for you? Never mind me, but what's right for you? If I'm invited, fine, I'll burp, right? And if you go to another place and it's not cool to burp, well, then don't burp. But I'm the kind of person who always burps. Or I'm the kind of person that never burps, right? So what do we do with that? I remember my cousin lived in Holland for a while, and he said that everybody farts. They can talk to you about whatever, and then they fart. And it's fine. Fart. Right? So, you know, yeah, I'm on the same wavelength, like burping, farting, right? So, right? Because it's, you know, something that we can relate to, right? So he was a bit uncomfortable at the beginning, he said, but then he got used to it. He was there for, I got used to it, and it was fine. And then he allowed himself to fall too while having conversations with people, right? So now again, is it right? Is it wrong? Now we can say, well, those are minor things, right? But what about the real right and wrong of, for example, killing or not killing, right? So yeah, that's no problem, but then here is the problem. But is it that? Is it how we grade it, or is it always the same mechanism of finding myself or avoiding the temptation to find myself in the idea of right and wrong? Again, it we have to change it from fixed to flexible. That's what we're practicing, changing everything from fixed to dynamic. If it's dynamic, that's fine. It's no problem. Burp, don't burp. It's all good. At the right time, at the right place. Right? So the point of reference becomes, has to do with time, place, situation, people, amounts, all that stuff. Right? Second perspective by which we study the precepts, by which we need to live our lives. So we need to be flexible, but not flexible as self-serving. Because often, yeah, we say, I'm flexible, but as long as it's serving me. Flexible as reality serving versus self serving. So, yeah, where are we at?
It's funny, like when the story was shared with me by the director of education, she was telling us that, you know, that she had this big, big quarrel in the classroom one time when she was a teacher for that, exactly what you're talking about. So there's two students in the back of the classroom, and one passed out, right? She farted. And the other girl got insulted. And she turned around and told her, I don't pay $20,000 to come into the classroom to learn and to be disrespected by you.
Mm-hmm.
She took it personally.
Right.
You're just sitting there farting right in front of me and everything. And that's not what I came here to school for. And she goes, the other student was like, it's natural. Like, she's like, what do you want me to do? Because I want you to get up and go to the bathroom and do it where you're supposed to be doing, not right next to me.
Right.
So they were fighting over that. And I was hysterical laughing. I couldn't believe that. That they were actually having this quarrel in the classroom that disrupted the whole learning process about who was right and who was wrong.
Exactly.
The same situation. And so the thing is, like you said, it's like where one person sees it as disrespectful and the other person sees it and it's a natural function of the body. What do you want me to do, you know? So, yeah, it was a big thing. So she was telling us, these things happen in the classroom and we have to have some kind of a control. And I said, as a learning leader, as a teacher, which one do I support? Which one's better? Which one's wrong? Because in my mind, they both have a point. You know, they both have a point. You know, it's like she doesn't want to be subjected to it, but she doesn't want to be told where is the right place or not the right place to do. So yeah, that was a tough one. You know.
Right, so it's a question of what is home. You could just turn it this way, I think it'll be enough. It's a question of what is home, right? So if I'm insulted, well, okay, yeah, I feel as if I've been wronged or harmed, right? But is it true, right? Is it that kind of a home, or is it a home that has to do with what I'm vested in? Right, so in a way, I mean, we talked about being arrogant, right? We are very arrogant, so we get together, 20 people, 30 people in the classroom, everybody comes in with their own demands of how you need to be for me.
Yes.
For me, right? Because I have my references and you better abide by my references or I'm not going to like you or I'm going to be insulted by you, mm-hmm. right? And then you do the same and the other 28 people do the same. So then you got 30 sets of references and demands, which is, you know, of course, it's not surprising that we don't get along as human beings. That's why we don't get along, because we're rigid. Well, we come into interacting with other people with very rigid sets of demands. Here is what I want you to do. Oh no, what I don't want you to do, right? I don't want you to be free to be yourself, no. Well, only if it corresponds with me, then that's fine, you can be yourself. So the question is, you know, can I turn it around and examine what in me got hurt, quote unquote hurt? What is it? That's exactly what I need to work on. That's my rigidity. Every time I get insulted, I have a great opportunity to work on something and dissolve it or not, or strengthen it. And the thing with rigidity is that it's brittle. It's very quickly breakable. So we do feel hurt. We break because of our rigidity, right? So, and it's good because it's showing us how much power we have in our hands all the time. No. Thank you.
Thinking of this in terms of education, in terms of what you're saying, and as a teacher, I feel like that rigidity then takes away from learning, as you were saying as well. And if I'm inflexible as a teacher, I was just thinking about different things that have happened in my classroom as a result of rigidity and wanting things to be a certain way, and the administration is telling you, I want this way, follow the curriculum, follow. But then when you do that, you're not allowing your students to learn flexibility, you're learning conformity, which isn't exactly what we want them to learn, is it? Because if we think outside of the box, then we have a different world later, hopefully. They develop those ideas and it becomes different for them. But we'll never have a different world unless we allow them to see that, oh, we can go this way. Like they bring up something that's maybe off topic, maybe it's not my lesson plan, maybe it's not the curriculum, maybe it's not part of that, but it's important to them, and I go with it. And then I see how interested everybody becomes in the other person's ideas. And then it develops. So just in terms of rigidity, what you're saying, just allowing things, allowing the kids to be flexible. And then we teach other people to be flexible that way. I've had that problem of rigidity before in my classroom. I've wanted to conform to the administration, and sometimes I have to say I don't. Because I can't, because the kids are telling me they want something.
Right. Thank you for one quick thing. I'm gonna see if anybody else wants to say. So I think that we encounter often. That's okay. We encounter rigidity very often, and very often we it's very apparent to us what it means to be rigid. Mostly about other people. Not so much about ourselves, because our focus is on others. He, she, them are being rigid, but then. It may be true, but then we have to turn it around and ask, where am I rigid? Where, ask because I am, not am I, am I not? That's not the right question. Where am I rigid? What are my triggers? What is it that I'm going to go and fight for by yelling at other people or doing this or get really upset about? So we have to look and see as a, we're looking at a mirror. So we can see our own uptightness, right? Anyone else about that? Okay, so I want to go back to something in the commentary where it says, Zen and Buddhist traditions have never been comfortable with the equivalent of biblical notions of right and wrong or just and unjust. Such thoughts are seen as impediments to clear seeing, to making the world transparent through radical transformation. So clear seeing, what is clear seeing? So we think of clear seeing, logically, right? Speaking, we think of clear seeing as seeing right and wrong, right? That's clear seeing. I see what's right. I clearly see what you're doing wrong. That's as far as our clarity goes. But this is not, this is talking about, again, back to the beginning, let go of preferences. Let go of all the supreme ways without difficulty for those who do not pick and choose, who do not engage with picking and choosing. That's the point, right? So whatever the rights and the wrongs are in your mind, in our minds, that's what we have to let go of or not go with. They're not going to go anywhere, but we have to not go with as we sit down and practice on a regular basis. So I'm going to read the next one, and then if you have something to add to what we just talked about, you'll have a chance to do so. If your eyes are open, dreams will naturally cease, right? So closing eyes, opening the eyes, right? So clarity. So before it was equated to dreams. Now, if your eyes are open, dreams will naturally cease. If the mind makes no distinctions, all dharmas are of one suchness. In the commentary, he says that the sleeping eye here can be seen as a metaphor for living in ignorance, and dreams as a metaphor for samsara. Right? What happens, or the suffering that comes from living like that with our eyes closed. In the Buddha's teaching, ignorance has a central place in explication of how the wheel of samsara is constructed. The Buddha called it the truth of dependent arising, and it points to samsara as a construct-effect of causal factors that are ultimately rooted in ignorance. This is how it's born. This ignorance is not understanding the true nature of things of the world. The lack of understanding puts into place the compulsive cycle of longing, clinging, becoming. As one thing, longing, clinging, becoming, as a process. More than one Zen teacher has pointed out that without training in mindfulness, one sleepwalks through life. A Buddha is a person who wakes up. As in sleepwalking through life, one is subject to rebirth in samsara and suffering. The hold of longing, clinging, becoming continues to be powerful life after life. Continues to be expressed life after life as we go through life after life. By construct, the eye that never sleeps can be seen as a metaphor for living in transparency. Just as the eye that never sleeps will not dream, so too living in wakefulness will put a stop to sleepwalking through life. Being awake, one is free of the bondage of samsara, no longer subject to rebirth in it. This is the Buddha's template for nirvana. Now again, as we talked about last time, this is not a switch. This is not, before I was like this, now I'm like that. It doesn't work like that. Everything is intermingled, so we can have moments of wakefulness, which will follow by moments of sleep, right? And then we again create issues, create damage to go and fix and apologize and work with. So it's a process. It's a process. And with that, we also always have to remember that karma is there. So even if we do experience wakefulness, it doesn't mean we're not going to experience being stuck again in the same way. Now, it's not new stuckness. It's actually same old stuckness. So do you see it as something that you practice? Do you see it as something that you care for when you fold your legs and sit zazen, when zazen ends and you go about doing what you're doing? Do you see that as a, because it is an important point here, without practice, without the cultivation, we are going to continue to sleepwalk. Every time we react to things, we are actually sleepwalking, right?
One of the things that I try to keep in the front of my mind, and it's a practice thing, that I have to constantly be practicing over and over again, is if I enter into a situation, do I have expectations about how that situation is going to go or how people are going to act and things like that?
Right.
Because when you put those expectations on top of the situation, even before you encounter it, you're already picking and choosing right and wrong, good and bad. You know, this went the way I wanted it to, this didn't go the way I wanted it to. So, always trying to think, what do I have expectations about how this is supposed to go? And, you know, we all do, right? You know, at your job, you have a job, you know, you want the job to go a certain way, and when it doesn't, you know, if you cling to those expectations that it's not working out, then that's where you are, right? Versus not clinging to any expectations, just taking it as it comes, and then reacting to it from that perspective. So, from the position of practice, it's, for me personally, it's always, what expectation am I bringing to this situation, or to this person,
right?
Why isn't this person acting the way that I want them to? You know, why isn't this situation working out the way that I want it to work out? And I find if I can temper those expectations and take more of a, it's not really a wait and see approach, but more of an improvisational approach to the situation and kind of flow with it a little bit more, then things tend to be more equanimous, they're more peaceful from that perspective. But that approach of constantly revisiting expectations takes a lot of work. Because our immediate, at least for me, my immediate response is to, I want this to go like this.
Yeah.
Versus how is this going to go?
Right. Thank you. So you're talking about a practical way of examining, right? Or practical way of applying, right? Applying it or seeing, right? Working with it, right? So in entering, right? Entering, how am I? What are my expectations, as you said, when I enter, right? Yeah. When I go there, I'll go there, right? So the question is, where am I at, right? So if I'm looking at my state of being and I take responsibility for verifying and cultivating states of deeper state of being, right? Then I realize through practice that it is on me, right? If it is on me, then that reduces the level of expectation, the demand of the world, right? So I want you to do this or not do this because you're going to disturb my happiness, right? What am I saying when I'm saying that, right? So she with your example, so she felt that she got insulted, right? What am I saying? I'm saying I am in jail and you are the warden. Everybody is the warden. Everybody has key to my cell. I'm in jail. That's what I'm saying. I'm not free. I'm free as long as you don't do something that bothers me. That's what we're saying.
Everybody's in control of my happiness.
Totally. That's what I'm saying. So that's what we're saying. We're abnegating the responsibility. We are pushing it on others or the world or the weather. Mm-hmm. Right? And then, of course, we're going to feel like a ping pong. Right? Being flung from one side to another. We're happy, we're sad. We're ecstatic, we are depressed. Moment by moment, day by day. It's almost like we wake up in the morning and we ask the world, how am I today? What's my state of being? Am I happy today? Tell me if I'm happy. It's ridiculous state of affair. Because we don't take any responsibility. Or we take very little responsibility. And that's the primary aspect of our practice is sit down, shut up, take responsibility. Every day. Take full responsibility, not blame, responsibility. But it's not in my hands, is what we think. Because I have right and wrong. Wow, I cannot control other people. If they do something wrong, I get pissed off. So it makes perfect sense to the logical mind, to the provisional self. That's why it is sustained. That's why we sustain it. As ridiculous as it is, we actually work very hard to sustain it. So, anyway, yeah. Hang on 1 second. I want to make sure that we're not missing anybody. Also on Zoom, anybody wants to contribute? Okay, if you do, just unmute, please, and go for it. Okay? All right, anyone else here? Did you have something to say? Okay.
Now, just a quick point to piggyback on this that I think is not to split this hair even further and create more divisions of what have you, but I think there's one part of the discussion that's getting left out here is you can go, okay, I can't control these people, and you're coming at it from, like, if you think about it, like in martial arts terms, an offensive, mm-hmm. but there's also at least, you know, personality-wise, it's more akin to kind of how I've been going. I can't control these people. All I can control is my body. So now I have a defensive reaction, and I'm anticipating. I know one of the things that I've struggled with whenever we've tried Aikido in certain settings is my brain gets into the anticipatory kind of thing of going, this person's probably going to go this way because I've noticed they do that all the time. Mm-hmm. So now I'm anticipating that reaction rather than taking it in for what it is,
right.
And I'm trying to, because it ensures my safety, some people try to ensure their safety by being incredibly reactive and destructive or what have you, I ensure my safety by always knowing where the exits are, and trying to kind of always anticipate a scenario, that too, even though, and it's easy to mistake anticipation as
right.
understanding reality as whole, when in reality I'm not taking in reality, I'm creating false scenarios and I'm reacting to that. So one of the biggest parts of my practice has been that, like, am I actually reacting to the thing in front of me, or am I reacting to a story about the thing in front of me that I've told in order to protect myself,
mm-hmm.
or whatever it is? What am I keeping so precious? And it's not saying that I think we've discussed this before, of going, it doesn't mean that you're just empty. It doesn't forego preparations. It doesn't, it doesn't mean that you don't practice ever. It just means that you have to be willing, which I guess gets back to this discussion about abandoning
mm-hmm.
things
mm-hmm.
going. Just because you're doing, you know, I've seen footage of you, you know, you're doing that, with the Kenny, or
okay.
whatever, where you
okay.
you do
yeah.
that for the first third or 50% of the class. It's just doing that over and over and over again. And it doesn't mean that this is all there is, or that you hold on to doing it a certain way, or years of practicing with the same people have grown accustomed to the way that you do certain things. You still have to be willing to drop all of that at a moment's notice, because, I don't know, it doesn't make it any less or worth doing.
No, right, anticipating. It's true that you do get to, just one note on that, you do get used to, so, and that's why we always encourage people to go to seminars and train with people they don't know.
Yeah.
So I just got back, I was a couple of days at a seminar, and at a very large seminar. In seminars, usually people switch partners every time, every technique. Mm-hmm. And you bow to whoever's next to you, and whether or not you know them, it doesn't matter. Make us, you may not know them, you bow, and you don't know what to expect. Because you don't know what to expect, it actually is freeing you from expectation. You don't know what to expect. You gotta keep your eyes open, you gotta be open physically, mentally, and then perceive what comes and work with what comes, not with what you think should or should not be. Right? Go ahead.
No, I was just gonna talk.
Just so if you want, project your voice, well, you can leave the microphone.
I'll try to project my voice. So I was just thinking about Aikido, what you were saying, and I've experienced wanting things to be a certain way, wanting people to respond a certain way, so that I could do the techniques that I wanted to do. But then we have juaza, which is kind of a freestyle. We have multiple attackers, we have people coming at us, and we have to have all the techniques all at one moment, right? And so having that, it's like knowing how to move the energy. You can't move the energy the way you want to. You have to move the energy the way the person's coming in at you. You then have to look at how short or tall they are, how, what kind of energy they have, the aggressive energy they have, like timid energy, and they don't really want to, what am I dealing with? And you have to deal with it like in that moment. And I think juaza practice has really helped me understand that I can use that energy and absorb it and do something else with it without having to dictate to the person, you have to come in this way so I can do this, But taking it into my life is a different story. and I would love to be able to do juaza all the time, but that kind of flexibility again is just really necessary.
And that's a practice. That's a lifelong practice. That never culminates, right? That's an important point. It never ends. Did you want to raise your hand or just, okay, playing with the earring, okay. Did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Yeah, please.
So you were talking about, we're talking a lot about reaction, and a couple of weeks ago you were talking about the deer that were in your backyard and how they respond to certain situations, and I was thinking about the difference between reacting and then responding to things. Like when I think of reaction, I think of like a reflex, like it's no thought involved and no input from whoever I am is doing anything. But like I was bird watching yesterday and there was no, they were chasing each other and there was no reflexes. They weren't reacting to each other. They were like responding to each other and chasing each other back and forth across the field, so much so that I didn't know if they were attacking each other or if they were playing with each other. And I don't know what that is to say, but it seems like that would be a practice rather than just something inherently that beings know how to do to respond to a situation rather than react. And I think that's something for myself to try to incorporate into my daily life, whether it's at work or with kids or things like that, to be able to respond and flow in the moment rather than just reflexively react.
Right, so the word impediments, right? So what is impeding on our natural, you talk about natural reactivity, right? We have that. There is, like any creature, right? Obviously, the simple example, touch something hot, you're gonna naturally pull away from that, right? So we have that in us, the ability to react naturally to life, But then on top of that, layered on top of that, many layers on top of that, we have the impediments, right? The things that are impeding us from and our own life, right? Karma throughout our own life, maybe karma from before, right? Everything is working together, right? And also maybe fears we have developed over the years, right? From being exposed to something, right? And so all of this is working in the background. And it just, the problem is it becomes all meshed together. So we think this is natural. I'm naturally responding here, right? This is a problem. And because it becomes so tight, so interwoven into what we call natural reactivity. So of course it's the body that's reacting. And you say, well, the body is naturally reacting, but it's not just that. And so we have to work on becoming more and more aware of what am I not seeing here? What's making this come up, right? This immediate reactivity. Maybe we can't do it right there on the spot, right? But maybe later we can go back and think about it and examine and maybe learn something. Right? That's important. Anyone else? Yeah, Eric. Hang on. We need to give you the... Maybe, but we'll give you the microphone just in case.
Talking about bringing your expectations to a situation and letting them govern how you react as opposed to maybe just a natural reaction. I have this Phoenix, my wife has an Apple Watch, and they do sleep tracking. And we've had a rain gag for a few years now where when we finally have a cup of coffee together in the morning, one of us would say, how do you sleep? And the other would go, oh, I didn't look at my phone yet. Because in this, you know, monitored, engineered life, you don't just go, okay, or no, not very good. You have an expectation that you have to sleep 8 hours and 2 hours of REM, and your pulse ox was, you know, at least 95 and all that. And I think that made me think about, you know, bringing your expectations to something rather than just saying, am I tired or not? What's important? Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of my work, what customers tend to, especially customers, my expectation, tend to miss the point,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to, in my case, Oxford commas and capitalization. You know, it's, I think what this brings to us when we're clearly seeing is what is important in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is this person my friend? Is this person my spouse?
Right.
I don't want to get into a fist fight right now. I don't want to get into a fist fight right now. But what's important?
Right. It's a very good point. Do you want to pass back?
Are you a fan of the Oxford comma?
Yes, but I'm not going to spend more than about a minute. I'll leave over it.
So it's a really good point and that you raised, right, in terms of technology, right, how it interferes, and we can definitely spend a lot of time talking about that. We're not going to do it today, but yes, technology, right? So even, you know, a simple example of having, you know, relying on GPS, right? And, you know, most of us know life before GPS or before iPhones, right? Before phones. And in a way, you know, when you think about, you know, traveling with a map, right? Versus traveling with a GPS, there is something that is much more in contact with reality in us, right? And then there is a buffer. And we go to the thing that buffers, right? We go, we ask. We no longer go inwardly and ask, right? So Zen speaks of direct interaction with reality, right? And technology actually speaks of the opposite of that. It does the opposite. It makes us numb. Now you gotta wonder, right? You know, after years of not using maps, have we lost something, right? Have we killed an ability in us, right? Because it's very right to and you know, most of you know, right, to travel with a map, you have to have a different way of seeing the road. Mm-hmm. It's almost like you're driving, but at the same time you're also flying from above, and you have an eye above that sees that you know where you're going, right? So there it's much more developed way of thinking or being, right? But then we plug into a thing and then that's it. And it looks like we're moving more and more in that direction, right? Because we don't want to do anything. We don't want to bother too much. We don't want to sweat.
That's true in terms of reading as well.
But then we go further into dying before we die. Mm-hmm. We die before we die, and I think that's a shame.
Yeah, I actually want to challenge everybody to read something on the internet without clicking on the link that highlights the word.
Me too. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, we click. Do you want to say something, Doki?
No.
Okay.
To
read without clicking on the... Without clicking. You know, when you read an article online,
yeah,
the tendency is to click to see, you know, we go from one to another.
Oh.
When you read a book, there's no clicking. So, obviously, it's a different experience, right? Because there is the temptation. It's not that we always do it, but there is the temptation, and then it's very difficult to avoid the temptation because it's designed to draw us in. It's designed to do that. It's actually designed to numb us. Right, so yeah, that's definitely a shame. Anybody on Zoom? We're good? Okay. Did you want to say something?
No, I just want to add a comment. This also becomes smarter.
Please.
Gadgets are smarter, but not us.
Yes, we become dumber.
We become reliant.
Yeah.
That's the whole thing. We lose the ability to think and then just act on our own.
But that's, yeah, that's the point.
I've heard from students and younger, you know, workers, oh, I have to Google it to see what it says. No, it's not Google who is going to make you think. You have to think on your own.
Exactly.
Right. So what Eric was saying, you know, instead of going to the body, we go to the device. And what happens, I think maybe more importantly, we stop trusting our ability to feel it, to experience. I don't know how I feel. Let me ask. Let me read about how I feel. I don't know. And it may be true, because if I've been using it for a long time, I may not know anymore. I may not know what to turn into anymore. Because we lose the pathway. Right, so thank goodness that Zazen doesn't require any device, right? You know, just floor. If you want to make it more comfortable, put a cushion on it, that's it.
Maybe an app which would control, digressing from what I need to do, not focusing on my breath. Hey, come back to, you know, focusing on your breath. It might come sometime soon.
So shock collar.
Yeah, there's probably an app that, will... that will examine the quality of your Zazen. I'm sure there is something that examines and then will grade you.
Quality.
I'm sure there is something out there.
Yeah, it's something called the quantified self movement, where everything can essentially be reduced to a number depending on, and the issue they feel is not enough data sets. So it's going, okay,
right.
We got the Fitbit, we got this and this, and now it's trying to discover everything can be quantified and then in turn optimized. And so that's why I'm like kind of very much not on board.
Well, you said a very important word, reduced.
Yeah.
Right, and what we're working on is expanding.
Yeah.
And that's exactly that.
Even before technology, though, I think that some of this is embedded into the system, whether what you brought up about education of going, are we teaching our students to feel and follow inquiry, or are we teaching them and slowly reducing it to conformity, and the large part of, you know, secondary education is centered around that. I came back to Zen because I felt a deep disconnection with my felt sense of everything was up here, everything was thought through, everything was that. I don't know what my body does or reacts, and from years of, you know, you can't discredit how much just existing in the world as it is scrambles that felt sense.
Right.
You can't trust these things. So Zen takes that very simple thing of just returning to the center, and you slowly learn how to listen.
Mm-hmm.
Relearn. But it's just interesting.
Have you heard Ken Robbins?
Relearn or unlearn.
Mm-hmm.
I have to send it to you.
Please, yes.
I love him so much. I was so sad when he passed.
Okay, I'm going to move on. If you have something to say, make a note of it and share. In the profound essence of this suchness, one abandons all conditioning. Beholding the myriad dharmas in their entirety, things return to their natural state. Another translation, to understand the mystery of this oneness, one essence, is to be released from all entanglements. When all things are seen equally, the timeless self-essence is reached. When all things are seen equally, which is exactly where what we move towards when we let go of all parameters, right? We let go of parameters. The only thing that make us see things not, or not see the equality of all things, is attaching ourselves to parameters, to differentiation, to likes and dislikes, good and bad, with or go towards or go away from. Commentary, to see everything the way this, to see everything the way this way, everything the way this way, is to free oneself from all entanglements, which are the headlong pursuit of food, sex, sleep, wealth, and fame. They bind us to the world of projections, inferences, preferences, discriminations, and self-gratification. They constitute the realm of samsara, dukkha, unsatisfactoriness. When one has penetrating insight into the dependency arising nature of all entanglements, one has the cognitive, affective, and behavioral thrust for opening the hand of thought, as Kocho Uchiyama puts it. Opening the hand of thought is the metaphorical opposite of holding the hand in a tight fist at all times, hence the rigidity, right? Grabbing, one hopes that the desirable entanglement, one is looking for something in a specific way. But a clenched fist becomes painful and constrictive after a while. Similarly, trying to hold on to desirable entanglements proves to be equally painful and constrictive. Opening the hand of thought means that even in the midst of pressure, the pressures generated by longing, clinging, becoming, one is disciplined enough not to close one's hand around these entanglements and lock it into a fist. An open hand is not forced, discriminatory rejection of things of the world, but rather seeing through them as construction without any self-abiding structural call to them. So things don't have a self until and unless we give it to them. Right? If we engage with things or even preferences with the demand to find myself in that, then they do have a self. But if we engage more openly or with the hand open, then we're not looking for a self, therefore we're not finding one, and it's easier to move, it's easier to flow. To pick up this, to drop that, then to pick up this, then to drop that, freely. Shunyata perspective is the liberation of the conditioned mind. Shunyata perspective is the liberation of the conditioned mind. So here's a very important question about all of it, right? For us, does it seem possible or impossible? Does it seem within something that is a state of mind or being that is within our reach and capacity, or something that we would love to experience, but we don't really feel that we have what it takes?
That's the wrong question.
What?
That's the wrong question.
Okay, ask the right one.
Yeah, I mean, it's the wrong question to see it as a destination, something that you're gonna get to this point. Like, you're free to practice, and you have every capacity to practice right now. That's it. And then, of course, I mean, like at the beginning, like everything you practice is going to be not good, not as good. And then you get better. And that's what this is about. It's not about reaching or achieving or getting to that point. You probably will never get to that point on time.
Right. So in terms of practice, in terms of Zen teaching, reaching is not somewhere else. Reaching is today, right? So arriving, the arrival is always today, right? Because whenever it is that you experience arrival, it is today, right? So that's never an issue right there, because there's no gap. The question is, do we trust that we have it within us to actually open it up in such a way? Or are we so vested in our preferences and notions of likes and dislikes, right and wrong, that that just block it completely, right? That's the question. And it's very important that we always, whatever happens, right, however stuck we may feel, it's very important that we find a way to remain encouraged. Very, very important. No matter how stuck we feel, we have to know how to regenerate that sense of encouragement. That's on us, right? That's why I wanted to see where we're at with this. Are we able to do that? Yeah. Oh no, Sugyo, she hasn't said anything. Go ahead. You speak first. Thank you, Scott.
It can seem both ways. It can seem sometimes impossible and sometimes possible. And when it seems impossible, it seems impossible. And I can't imagine the way to get unstuck. For me, it's been a process over time to see how the impossible shifts in an unanticipated way, and then building up a memory. Many times I feel so stuck for months, for years, and then something opens and shifts, and that happened, and that means that can happen again. And beginning now to see to see what little techniques there might be for me to encourage the shift. But still, at times it can seem impossible, and then various moods take over. I don't know, it seems like a gradual thing. You have to hang in there. I have to hang in there.
We, yeah.
And keep coming and keep talking to someone.
yes.
I'm in the way.
Both of you. As one who is more encouraged about my capabilities than I sometimes am.
Thank you. So, yeah, I wanted to add something to what you just said. And so you're saying, I examine my experiences, right? And I experience this, and then I experience that, right? Okay, so if I experience without measuring, without, right, quantifying it, I experience some measure of freedom, right? Inner freedom that has nothing to do with the circumstances being favorable, unfavorable, right? That's a teaching. Isn't it?
Yes.
It is teaching me that I have the capacity.
Yes.
Because if I did not have the capacity, there's no way I would experience it ever. Ever. Not even 1 minute. It means I have the capacity today. And it's not partial capacity. It's full capacity. Even if it's only a minute, it doesn't mean it's only a minute long kind of capacity. The capacity is there. Meaning the capacity to open my eyes. The fact that they close doesn't mean that I cannot open them.
And I find it important to, even if it's just a minute, to really acknowledge when something is, when there's a non-habitual experience mm-hmm. that is more open and say, mm-hmm. take that time to say, this has happened. And
so that could be encouraging, right? We talk about encouraging, right? So when we feel stuck, right? When we feel like nothing is moving, we do have the recollection of a time, right? Of an experience when things felt lighter.
Mm-hmm.
We do have that, right? In our recollection. So we say, well, yeah, that's true, but it's not the only thing that's true. Meaning it's true as an experience, but there are other kinds of experiences which I have experienced. Right? So, and that's exactly what we need to, so at moments like that, we need to let go of wanting to run back to or run away from. Because it's the same inherent you always that feels this and experiences that. It's not another kind of you. I'm not talking about fixed you. It's the same vast essence of you that experiences this and that. Right? So that's showing you how vast you are. Right? Because otherwise your experiences will be limited and repetitive.
I think the stuckness comes from rejecting that. Rejecting this, the
capacity
of the stuckness. Like you get more stuck because you're rejecting the stuck.
Because I don't want to be stuck.
Exactly. And so because you reject it, right, then it becomes something that you need to overcome or be away from or something like it's not. And then the, you know, the realization is about like, okay, this is something else and something as, you know, another experience, not a bad one or a good one or a stuck one or a not unstuck one or lighter or heavy. Like the moment that we pick and choose that this is heavy and this is not heavy, then we are dooming ourselves to not see. So how do you enjoy your stuckness is like kind of like question. It's very tough because you know, like you don't seem, I mean, we don't seem to enjoy it, but we don't enjoy, which is natural. But how do we open to say, okay, this is what's going on, and then as everything that's going on, it will last as long as it lasts, and it will go away, and it will be different. You know, and so have that patience. I noticed that the patience is what is the key on these things. It's like, okay, I have the patience, I have the space to hold this stuckness, to hold this sensation of shitty day. You know, and I have the patience to hold it. And then after some time, it will go away, and then that's it. You know, and it will just turn into something else. And which it could be worse or could be better, I don't know. Like, you know, but those worse and better are always measured on the scale that we should know, but we should not pay too much attention to. Because that's the scale of operation in the world, but not the scale of things as they are.
So, Santi Palamita, right? So the perfection of forbearance, right? You talk about forbearance, which is, right, something, obviously, the quality that we have to cultivate, right? So forbearance, so it doesn't mean we're going to enjoy feeling pain or feeling stuck or feeling melancholy or whatever's going on. But it's not a matter of enjoying, it's a matter of allowing for, right? It's a matter of finding the space.
I think, you know, what I wanted to say with enjoy is that the moment that you are, and this happened to me a couple of times, the moment you are kind of connected with the feeling and you're not rejecting the feeling anymore, it seems to open in a different way.
Right.
It seems to have a different kind of beauty. I don't see beauty is maybe too much, but, you know, like a different kind of saying to it. And I've done that with pains, with physical pains and with other things, that then it turned into something that is, oh, okay, this is a kind of different. It's not like, it's like, oh, okay. And that is the sensation that you can open and you can remember to open. Because when, like, it's true, the moment that we open it a couple of times, that's the practice, then you remember, oh, I can open this. I can actually look at this with this forbearance mindset. And it opens up. And it brings space, and then you can, you know, again, it's not the word, enjoy is not the word, but that.
Yeah, like knee pain at sashimi, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's a perfect example.
That's a perfect example, and that's how I learned at the beginning. That was my initial practice for me at 10. I would say this, and like, my sitting was like super painful for a very long time, and I learned so much from the pain, and sometimes I kind of missed it, because it's like, it's, you know, it's like I don't feel the pain anymore. And it's like sometimes it's like, oh, you know, because I remember how good it was for my practice to kind of be with it. You know, and so it's a shame and kind of going back to that.
Yeah. We can arrange some of this.
It's a shame enough.
Okay. We can help. But yeah, the point in that is whatever's going on, to avoid the temptation to create an alternative, right, in the mind, and then I want to go to that right now, right? I don't want to gradually get there. I want to get there now. That's creating a lot of suffering, a lot of extra pain.
I mean, I think we were discussing right now about how it's always available, and we think that then, okay, the next time I have like this pain, I will kind of fight for this availability and find it. And like, it doesn't work like that. If we were to work like that, we would kind of be phenomenal at some practice. It doesn't work like that. Like, the only thing you can do is just there. You know, and the wearing itself will bring that other stuff.
Right.
But it doesn't start with like, okay, I need to find where, and like, it's not that. I mean, the more you try to look at it, the less it will show.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, saying that we have the ability to actually cultivate this or feel this, there's a couple of scenarios that I remember from the beginning of my meditation, and I had a couple of those moments, and when things get really heavy and difficult, I remember that I did experience at one time or another something that felt really spacious and open, and we had at work, we had to park our cars, you know, going around and into this area, and I dreaded it every day because it was so cold. It was just so cold to walk and go and come back. And I don't know what happened one day after. I was just like, I just gave into the coldness and everything. I went and I parked my car and I'm walking back. And I just felt like, I just, instead of going like this, I just opened up.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like the coldness and the wind, everything was flowing right through me. And all of a sudden, I didn't feel it.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt so alive. And I was like, oh my God, where is that coming from, you know? Because I didn't, you know, contract rejected the coldness. It was just amazing. That was one experience, and I was like, okay, I don't know where that came from or what it is, but, you know, it felt good, right? There was another situation where I felt really, really, really heavy. And it was in a situation, I think I spent like when we moved into it, we created this zendo at that one house. And I think I cried from the beginning. I was going through a difficult, really difficult situation. I was like, I don't really want to be here. You know, I should be preparing for this, preparing for that. And then finally, I just sat through it. And I just felt like, okay, just sit. And the longer I sat, I felt like this heaviness at the beginning. And then I felt like every sitting session, I felt like layers were being lifted. By the time I finished there, I felt like, again, completely open. And it's like my heart was exposed or something. I don't even know how to describe it. But I felt like, oh my God, this feels really cool. It feels really light. And when I had to go, it was a court thing that I had to go. And when I went there, I normally would be nervous and like afraid and everything. And I just felt so calm. So whatever was going in my mind and whatever I was afraid of, I released it the whole time I was sitting. At the time the actual moment came, I felt like, what am I afraid of? I've been through this before.
Mm-hmm.
I came out okay, you
right,
know?
Right.
So I let it go. So it is there. The thing is that we have to pay attention to the opportunities and the moments.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we're expecting something and we want, and I still do, because I've experienced it before, so sometimes I want to force things to come. I want to like, just go deeper. No, you just got to just relax and let it happen, you know, naturally, and it will. You just got to pay attention and give it an opportunity to let it come through, you know, let it come through.
Right.
And I think that's, the ability, we all have the ability. We all have situations that obviously we need to work through and work with, and just embrace it and say, what do I need to learn? What do I need to let go? And then just let it happen.
Mm-hmm.
It's
very empowering, right? So it's revealing something in terms of capacity, right? But it's also very empowering, right?
Yeah.
Because it is teaching us that we can, that we have the ability. It's also helping us develop a better sense of trust, right? Trust in something greater than the particular experience, right? Or how we feel about the experience at that moment. At that moment, learn to trust in something far greater than that, right? So we don't contract to that, right? So we expand. So the physical, and that's very true, right? Because the natural reaction, right? And that's the question, right? How natural is it? It is natural reaction to contract when we are experiencing cold, right? But when we go the opposite direction, when we actually work on breathing and relaxing to it, the cold becomes less cold. I mean, there's a point, obviously, that you can get hurt. But we're not talking about that, right? But so there's a point that it can be good exercise, right? To relax rather than to contract. And then something changes. Something changes. And that I think is very empowering. Jaka, did you want to say something? No, you. Don't look away. just, I don't know if you disconnect with what you've been experiencing with the injury and the recovery.
There's lots of things throughout the conversation. I mean, actually, someone was talking about GPS before, and I kept thinking about going hiking, you know, in the woods. And actually, the other day, I was hiking with a friend, and we're just gonna do like a quick hike just down the road in Ramapo, and we decided to just jump off the trail and kind of like walk through the woods. And I don't know, you get out in the woods and you're off the trail and there's no map. You kind of, you're not like, oh, now I need to pay attention more, but you just see things better. You can kind of see like where, you know, you can be walking through like little brambles and just, oh, like this is clearly a deer path, like this little herd path, like there were deer here, and then,
right,
you know, there's the deer droppings, you know.
You pay more attention.
You're just there more. When you kind of lose the crutch of the map,
yeah,
the trail, the GPS, and yeah, so you see more. So that was something talking about GPS before, connecting with.
Thank you. Yeah, we do see more. We are going to actually wrap it up. So we have a few more minutes that we can either let go of or use. Okay, raise on.
I think right and wrong are tools that we can use, and language, and we have all of these tools that we've developed, which help us meet situations like walking through the woods. But the danger of them, and what very quickly happens, is they identify the situation that we're getting into rather than helping us meet the situation. As a teacher, was always a fine balance. We were talking about this at the seniors meeting. If you're giving students an experience that they haven't had previously, how much do you need to prepare them to have the experience? Because in many situations, what you think they would get out of this experience, they don't even perceive. It's not even interesting to their consciousness. Or reading a book, or an episode that takes place, it doesn't even enter that there's anything there. So this balance between tools that help us get into an experience versus tools that predefine, like you were saying, about the expectations. And I know what this is, I can do this. And the more technological we become, the more we're involved with that sort of stuff. So all of these tools, how do we keep those tools, in those usual words, fresh, dynamic, all of that stuff. And curiosity, certainly, we keep coming back to that, well, it seems to be a piece of this, that, you know, when I'm in a situation and I've got, you know, I know how to do this, I've done this before, and so on, the possibility that it might be something different than what it is. And because all of those tools are designed to save time and to do things quickly, and you know, patience isn't the issue here, getting things done is the issue, that we're always working against all these forces in us, which are pushing us, you know, it's a tool, damn it, use it. Why aren't you using GPS? We didn't use GPS for years and had many very angry people tell us, you should be using GPS, you idiot. It's very, very difficult. Right? And everything in our lives is been created to make our lives as easy for us as possible in very realistic ways, like not being killed and so on. It's very important that our lives be made as easy as possible in certain ways. But then we have to, at some point, come to some sense that we also have to challenge that in some way. Certainly sitting is one of the ways of challenging, and discussions like this is one of the ways of challenging. And they're critical. This is, our lives are at stake. We get to the end of our lives, and our tombstone will be, she used her GPS really well, or she always followed what Siri told her to do.
She was a Google expert.
Yeah. Anyway, tools, right and wronger tools, they're for our use, and we should realize that.
Thank you. So, yeah, so it's a question of who's using who, right? So, and often, I think often with technology, we become the tool. It's actually aiming for us to become the tool, to become the subject, right? Because a lot of it has to do with, you know, keep buying, keep consuming, right? So the longer you stay on it, the higher the chance that you will consume. So it has to do with that.
Some people with their iPhones, it just looks like they're a machine, right? I mean, they are totally an automated device which is serving the iPhone.
Well, here's the thing, you know, comfortable may feel good. Too comfortable is numbing. How do we know? Right? Is it, you know, going further and further into comfort to a point of sleepwalking, as right in the commentary, right? That will encourage us to sleepwalk. Don't think too much. Look at this. It'll think for you. Literally, these days, right? Ask it, it'll tell you exactly what you need. You don't do anything. So we've numbed a lot of capacities already. We're just gonna keep numbing further, more and more capacities. Whatever we don't use in the brain, it's just, we lose it. So there is a high price. There's a high price to pay for that. Okay, we can finish.
It reminds me of Star Wars, when Luke is in his machine and people are telling him to use his scope. And instead he uses, and Ben Kenobi's like, use the force, you know. Yeah. And he uses his intuition instead, and he nails it.
But even in that kind of quandary of that, and then also the way you're phrasing it, is it's all predicated upon an individual who is willing to be open to reflect on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where do I end and the technology begins and vice versa? Because I think there is, by nature, whether it's a piece of, you know, an iPhone or a stick to get something off the wall, technology can be seen as an extension of our will in that way. But it has to then have that moment of going, can I use this? I get accosted because I find no use value in an air fryer. And they go like, oh, you know, this changes my life, and I just don't have any use for it because it doesn't add or do anything beyond what you said of efficiency of consumption, and there's so much technology that's centered and designed around efficiency of creating new forms of consumption.
Yes.
But it's just kind of that element of going, it still starts with somebody no different than being open to bodhicitta or something like that, of going, you need somebody who's kind of already been tenderized a little bit to be open to the experience of reflecting. Is this good for me? Is this bad for me?
Right, asking the question, not going along with the trend.
Yeah.
Is what you're saying,
yeah.
Right? The trend says buy it, use it.
Yeah.
But where's the question here?
And
right.
It also begs the question, what is going with the flow? Is going with the flow going with the trend, or is it going with the greater trusting in something greater?
Right. So then we have to ask the question, yeah, it may be useful, but it's useful for me.
Right.
It may be good, but is it good for me in relation to my life, right? Is it? So that's the question of personal responsibility. Because
yep.
Nobody's going to do it for us. Because once the invention is out there, it's out there.
Yeah.
That's it. There's no going back. Nobody's going to ask when things are invented. They don't ask, will it be good for people in general? Will they become more calm? You know, will they become more connected to who they are? Nobody's asking them. They don't care about those questions.
No.
It's like, well, how much of it we can sell is the bottom line.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line, how many of it, this product can be sold?
Mm-hmm.
So that's the motivating question. On the other side, on our end, we need to ask the real question of, what do I do with it? What do I need to do with it? So, anyway, we'll end with that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Bodhisattva vows. Bodhisattva vows for all.
Creations are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible.
Each of us must strive to awaken, awaken. Take heed, do not squander your life.